Shabbat shalom, everyone. So I'm starting a new series. We're in this time of new beginnings anyway, with the Torah portion starting all over, our reading cycle. And so I wanted to start with something for our new year, at least the new cycle, that's kind of in alignment with all that's going on around the world, especially here in the United States. So I thought, let's do something apocalyptic, right, to kind of match all the craziness that's going on all around us. So I have opted to do a sermon series on the Great Red Dragon, right? Boo! The Great Red Dragon. So, on a more serious note, you have an enemy. He is a skilled predator. He is patiently waiting to pounce on you and rip your life away from you. He is the ancient serpent, the evil one, the great red dragon. He is most widely known as Satan or the devil. He has a kingdom. He has wisdom, power, a fallen army of angels and demons at his behest. Jesus said concerning him, he's a liar and a murderer from the beginning. One of his greatest lies is to get the masses to believe that he, his kingdom, and his agenda doesn't exist. But the sacred scriptures expose him for who he is. And the Bible reveals his agenda, his aspirations, and his existential threat to everyone who believes in Jesus and commits themselves to the commandments of God. So in this series, we will discover how to not only survive the devil's attacks, but to overcome him. Our main text will be Revelation chapter 12. Before we go there, our chair passage is 1 Peter 5:8. Peter says, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. That's insightful when you think about it. Peter's saying, be sober-minded, be clear-minded, be disciplined, stay on your guard, keep awake and watch at all times. Why? Because your enemy is wise and ancient, and he's just laying in wait for you and I to become passive or careless. His intent is to take us out. He's a murderer. Never forget that. As a truth seeker, you have the advantage. If you have a heart for the truth, if you love truth, you have an advantage over the evil one. Our job is to stay awake, clear-minded, and do not take the enemy for granted. Now, your mind is the main battleground. That's where it all is happening. It works its way out from there, but that's where it begins. That's where the battlefield is won or lost, in the mind. Everything else is just the outworkings of that. Think about it. Thoughts are the seeds of behavior. You don't just behave. It's not instinctual. It's based on ideas we embrace that lead to our choices and our behavior. What we think about, what we embrace, will lead to the choices that we make. Choices that we make every day, by the way. It is astounding when you stop and think about all of the decisions we make every day, all day long. Now, some of those are mundane, not big deals. But we're confronted with some choices that when we decide one way or the other, can put into motion for years to come consequences. Our choices will lead to behaviors which then lead to lifestyles. Those lifestyles become ways of life or ways of death. Ways of life leading into blessing on different levels in different ways, or ways of death that lead into a diminishment of our life experiences, into a place of misery and chaos, into a place of death itself. Suicide is commonplace to the human dilemma. In many ways, it is the choice we make to try to escape our misery, playing right into the ultimate game plan of the enemy, who wants to take our lives away. When our eyes are opened and we begin to understand what life is all about and the spiritual realm and how it overlaps with the natural realm, all of this becomes vitally important. C.S. Lewis, I think it was the Screwtape Letters, but one of the works of the enemy is to convince people he doesn't even exist. There's no spiritual realm. There's no devil, you know. It's just life. I think John Lennon wrote, "There's no heaven, there's no hell." Maybe the pop song that kind of set that into motion, right? But the enemy just wants everyone to believe he doesn't exist. Well, he does. He's a liar. And he has set his gaze on us. Peter's writing to believers. He's writing to born-again, spirit-filled believers. He's saying to the believer, better stay awake. Be on your game. This ancient one, he plays for keeps. That was an eye-opener for me. I'd lived for years thinking the enemy's just after the lost. I read this and got some good teaching on it. Began to understand that the enemy isn't worried about the lost because they're already his. They're already captive to him. He's after the free person, the one that's in Christ, the one that represents a threat to his kingdom, his domain. He seeks for our lives. We're the target. Spiritual warfare is a phenomenon primarily for the believer. This is why the love for truth matters. If one has no regard for the truth, he or she is predisposed to seduction, deception, ultimately to enslavement, and even death. So let's jump into Revelation chapter 12 and get a perspective on Satan that will help us to understand how to overcome him. Revelation chapter 12. You ready? It is so good. I've been waiting for years to really unpack this in a way that is very practical, that will help us in a very real way in our walk with the Lord. So, as we jump into the book of Revelation, just keep in mind that the genre is apocalyptic. This is our type of literature. It's apocalyptic. Therefore, it's filled with signs and symbols and figures of speech. It's not meant to be taken literal. It's symbolic of things that are literal, but it's not literal in and of itself. And so as we approach this, keep this in mind. Our job is to decode the symbol so we can understand what the reality is, what the truth is. So Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. And a great sign appeared in heaven. This is John. He's seeing something. What he sees is this: a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. What does that mean? What's that symbolic of, right? What's he referring to? The short and skinny? Israel. Israel is the woman who's clothed with the sun and the moon. She's the one that has a crown of 12 stars. What are those 12 stars? They're the sons of Jacob, the 12 tribes of Israel. Yeah. Who is this moon and who is this sun? Well, that's Jacob and Rachel. This text is highly symbolic, reaching all. Actually, it's just the technology. Okay, maybe I should loosen this up a little. Okay, so where do we get these ideas? This is very symbolic. This is reaching back to symbols that everyone understood. This goes all the way back to the Torah. It goes all the way back to the first book of the Torah, Genesis. Joseph, remember Joseph and all the dreams that he had? Well, listen to this. One of his dreams, Genesis 37, 9 through 11. Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Behold, I have dreamed another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars." Why not 12? Because he's the 12th. He's having the dream. So he sees 11 stars. 11 stars bowing down to me. But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Dreams, the language of symbols. Dreams, just like apocalyptic literature, filled with signs and symbols. And Jacob decodes it right there. Jacob unpacks the dream right there. Oh, so the sun and the moon and the stars, 11 to be specific, are going to bow to you? What are you saying, son? That I and your mother and your 11 brothers are going to bow to you? Yeah, that was the interpretation of the dream. And we know it's true because that's exactly what happened. Later, bowing to him in Egypt, Zephaniah, the savior of Egypt. They did not know it was their own brother, but everything he dreamed came to pass. So John, the apostle, in Revelation chapter 12, uses that imagery that was fully established, trying to tell us something significant in his day about Israel. He goes on to say in verse 2, this woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, 12 stars in her crown on her head. It says she was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. What this tells us is that if it's symbolic of Israel, Israel is going to be pregnant and give birth. But how can a nation be pregnant and give birth? Because it's symbolic. The woman is symbolic of the nation. Isaiah 9, 6 through 7, an ancient prophecy given by the prophet Isaiah to the people of Israel. "For to us a child is born." To who? Us as a nation. Israel. To Israel a child is born. To us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and uphold it with justice, with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. This ancient prophecy is that Israel is given a child. Israel gives birth to not just any child, but the Mashiach, the Messiah himself. And the government on his shoulders shall forever increase and have no end. So in verse 2, she was pregnant, was crying out in birth pains and agony of giving birth. Verse 3, and another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. Just another kind of side note here. John's on the island of Patmos. He's there because he has been speaking truth. And the Roman Empire, the emperor himself, they didn't allow for that. They censored people who spoke the truth. They put people in prison for speaking the truth. You spoke only in alignment with the emperor and his agenda and his values, or you risked being censored and put into prison. He's on the island of Patmos for speaking the truth. So one of the reasons why these prophets would speak in such enigmatic ways was to keep their heads on their shoulders. So we have the language of symbols, but those that are on the inside know what he's talking about and who he's talking about. If he just spoke plainly, Rome would have his head on a platter. So verse 3, and another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his head 7 diadems. Keep in mind that the great red dragon represents Satan. We know that. And in verse 9, it says, the great dragon is the ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. We'll get to that next week. But keep that in mind. That's who the great dragon is. It's not a literal red dragon. They don't exist. He's not flying around there. It's not like Lord of the Rings or whatever, okay? It's a type and shadow. It's a symbol, if you will. It's referring to this divine fallen being known as Satan or the devil. More next week. But take note that he's red. What's red symbolic of? What is the symbolic value of red in apocalyptic literature? Red is the symbol of murder and mayhem. Revelation 6:3. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. And out came another horse. It's one of the four horses. Out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth so that people should slay one another, so that people would kill one another, murder one another. And he was given a great sword. Yeah, red. For murder and mayhem. Just like Jesus said, he was a murderer from the beginning. His art, murder. Revelation 12, he's about to paint his masterpiece. In the Tanakh, dragons are symbolic of evil world superpowers who persecute Israel. Let me give you an example, one of many. Ezekiel 29, 1 through 5. In the 10th year, in the 10th month, on the 12th day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me saying, son of man, set your face against Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Pharaoh was the monarch of Egypt, and Egypt was the superpower of the day. Son of man, set your face against Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and prophesy against him and against all of Egypt. Speak and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I'm against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon that lies in the midst of his streams. Don't you love that? The king of Egypt, the great superpower, is described as a great dragon lying in the midst of the Nile. He says, my Nile is my own. I made it for myself. God says, I'll put hooks in your jaws and make the fish of your streams stick to your scales, and I will draw you up out of the midst of your streams with all the fish of your streams that stick to your scales. I will cast you out in the wilderness, you and all the fish of your streams. You shall fall on the open field and not be brought together or gathered. To the beasts of the earth, to the birds of the heavens, I will give you as food. God describing the leader of the great superpower as a dragon, a serpent, that he will cast into the wilderness with all of his followers who have oppressed his people Israel. Yeah, this whole idea of Satan being a serpent, which is the same as a dragon, by the way. If you give a serpent wings, it's a dragon. Take the wings away, it's a serpent. It's a flying serpent. Yeah, and what does it symbolize? Well, the serpents are the craftiest of all the beasts of the field. Yeah, snakes are like that. They're creepy, sneaky, clever, crafty, you know. You never even know they're there until they're wrapped around you, sucking your life away. So God takes that imagery, which is an archetype, which all cultures understand, and applies it to this divine fallen being called Satan. He's not actually a serpent. It's symbolic of his character and his work. Horns, diadems, heads, they all represent great power, great authorities, and resources. The book of Daniel has four beasts, but the total heads of the four beasts, seven. John, of course, is drawing off that imagery. Complete, corrupt powers. These beasts are evil world empires that persecute Israel and the people of God. Revelation 12:4 says, his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. This is the imagery of war. You know, how many, we all saw Lord of the Rings, right? Most of us, right? Remember the great dragon at the end? Remember this, you know? I mean, he would take his tail. I mean, he'd whip that thing, and anything in its way, he would just blow it up, man. Whether it's parts of the castle or the city or people themselves. It's a great depiction, of course, of the power of the tail of this serpent. See this even in the natural realm, you can see this. So he takes his tail and he sweeps down a third of the stars of the heaven, casting them to the earth. It's the imagery of war and its casualties. There must have been a war going on in heaven. And he took a third of heaven's angels captive. It's a casualty of war. He overcame at least a third of them. We'll get into that next week. Keep in mind that stars of heaven are symbolic both of angels and of saints. Sometimes it's referring to saints, like in Daniel 12 and verse 3. It says, and those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But in this passage in Revelation, it appears that it's actually a reference to angels, that what he swept to the earth was the third of the angels. Again, we'll get to that next week. Verse 4, and the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. So how does that play out for John? What does that mean in his day, right? What's going on here? Because all of this is symbolic of his world, his times that he lived in. Enter King Herod. Now, King Herod was Rome's pick for governing Israel. Israel's under Roman domination, the fourth beast of Daniel. And this beast will ultimately crush Israel. So they appoint a figurehead for Rome, one of their own. That's King Herod. King Herod is as evil as Rome itself. Matthew chapter 2, dealing with the birth story of Jesus. It says, now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem, Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who is born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, and assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired to them where the Christ was to be born. And they told him, in Bethlehem of Judea. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him." Liar. Such a liar. Cunning. Deceitful. He's not going to come and worship baby Jesus. He's going to come and murder him. Yeah, he is being empowered by this imagery, these spiritual dark forces in high places, to do this work of murder, the murder of Messiah himself. Verse 9, after listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen, when it rose, went before them until it came and rested over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. There's baby Jesus with Miriam, this beautiful young Jewish virgin, this young woman, Mary, his mother, the woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet. Corporate Israel now dials down to one of its women who's going to give birth to the one Isaiah prophesied. So now it narrows down, and Miriam is reflective of the woman clothed with the sun and the moon and the 12 stars in her crown. And they fell down and worshiped him. Then opening their treasuries, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed for their own country by another way. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt, remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Then Herod, when he had saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all of the male children in Bethlehem. Murder and mayhem through this civil leader representing this superpower that wants to kill the king of the Jews. All of this is connected. The heavenly realm and the earthly realm, it's connected. All the leaders in the civil realm are aligning either with heaven or the fallen ones. And the agenda of heaven and hell is being played out right here in our own world. That's why all of this is so important. Herod is filled and inspired by the spirit of the great red dragon. And of course, that goal is to kill the Messiah before he's coronated as King of Kings. Verse 5, she gave birth to a male child, one who's to rule the nations with the rod of iron, but her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Acts 13:32. Paul says, "We bring you good news that what God had promised to the fathers, this he has fulfilled to us, their children, by raising Jesus. Also, it is written in the second psalm, as it is also written in the second psalm, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you.'" The whole attempt of Satan from Genesis chapter 3 all the way up to this point is to kill the Messiah before he's coronated King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Because once he's coronated, it's over. Once he's given all power on all authority, it's over. So the rush of the enemy from Genesis 3 is in every generation try to snuff out the Messiah. You see him attacking Israel over and over and over through all of these empires, hastily hoping to kill the Messiah. If he kills the Messiah, game over, coup d'etat. It's too late. Jesus is born, he's hidden, brought back, lives his life, dies on the cross, and then raises from the dead. When he raises from the dead, Paul says what was promised in Psalm 2 has now become a reality. Jesus has been coronated King of Kings and Lord of Lords. In Acts chapter 1, you see this in the final meeting with Jesus prior to being coronated in heaven as King of Kings. Let me read it for you. It starts in verse 6. So when they had come together, they asked him, this is post-resurrection, last conversation with Jesus. So when they had come together, they asked him, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? He said to them, it's not for you to know the times or seasons that the Father is fixed by his own authority, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. And when he had said these things, they were looking on. He was lifted up on a cloud and took out of their sight. And while they were gazing into the heaven, as he went, behold, two men stood there by him in white robes and said, men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who is taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. The woman has her child. The great dragon tries to kill him. He escapes and ascends into heaven. Miriam, the virgin, conceives, has a child. Herod, the king, tries to kill him. He escapes, and then he what? Ascends into heaven. Everything that John is saying has been played out in the life of Jesus. And he tells us this story in a way that keeps him undercover, under the radar, in terms of Rome. Verse 6, and the woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1260 days. So again, Miriam, she represents Israel, the Israel of God. All those Jewish believers, all those Gentiles that later get grafted in, this is the community of faith that she represents. And it says that God made a place for her in the wilderness. We'll see that the wilderness is a place of protection in apocalyptic literature. So he provides a place to protect her, and then he nourishes her while the dragon continues to seek for her life to snuff her out. It's God's promise to protect us, nourish us, in spite of superpowers trying to oppress us, censor us, imprison us, and have our heads. This is a story about how God preserves his people in the midst of great corruption all around us. This is the hope that we have. This is why even if our person doesn't get in the White House and everything grows much darker, we're going to be okay. Because God has prepared a place for us so that we can, what, be preserved, so that we can make it through the crisis as he shakes the nations to the ground. It's a win-win for us on November 5th. It's a win-win no matter what happens, because our God is going to see us through, and his agenda to save the world will come to pass regardless of the superpowers. So next week we'll get more into this and have some practical application. But for this week, as we go on to the next Shabbat, may the Lord just bless and keep you as he's always kept us. And let's hold our head high and know with great confidence we shall overcome. Shabbat shalom.